Okay, reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, section 1 on meditative absorption, the very last verse in that section, number 51, so just before Janmashtami, excuse me. We have, finished one chapter out of the, four sections, and maybe about a third of the book. But I think we'll go faster now, too, with the book out. It's just easier to study it. Upon the, the verse is Tasyapi Narodhe Sarva Narodhan Nirbija Samadhi. Upon the cessation of even those truth bearing samskaras, Nirbija Samadhi, seedless meditative absorption ensues. So these are wisdom, cessation of even wisdom, seedless meditation, absorption ensues. I'll just read the first paragraph. This is a long. We now come to the end of the road of the yogic process outlined by Patanjali. In Nirbija seedless samadhi, explains Vyas, both the illumined insight and discernment born in Sabija samadhi and the truth-bearing wisdom samskaras that accompany it are themselves rendered inactive. Vyas notes that the Narodha Samskara of 150, the restraining or suppressing Samskara, block or eliminate even those beneficial truth-bearing Samskaras of discrimination. The ensuing state of Nirbija Samadhi, the yogi's awareness has no contact whatsoever with Prakriti, external reality, either in its gross or subtle aspects. In other words, the chitta is not focused on any aspect of an object, gross or subtle, completely uncoupled from chitta, all mental and cognitive processes. Purusha is now aware simply of itself. There is a samskara that facilitates this by suppressing all samskaras whatsoever, including those of insight and wisdom. This is the Narodha samskara. As its name suggests, the ultimate samskara that produces absolute chitta vritti narodha. All thought is now latent, sarva narodha. Omigana timarandasya gyananjana shalakaya taksur unmutam yena tasmai sri gurave namaha. Bancha kalpa tarubhyascha kripa shindu bhayebhya patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ramo, Hare Ramo, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, we're at the end of this section. Also, tomorrow is Janmashtami. So let's see, I'm probably just going to speak a short while. Next section is the practice. So this was the chapter summary. The chapter begins by introducing and defining yoga, verse 1 and 2. This is followed by a discussion of the two possible options for awareness. A description of the vrittis, 5.11, and how to control the vrittis by practice and dispassion, 12 to 16. Then comes the division of samadhi into sampragata and asampragata, 7 to 18, and how to attain these, 20 to 22, after the discussion of other states that might resemble it, 19. Ishvara is then introduced as the easy method of attaining samadhi, 23, along with his nature, 24 to 26, and the chanting of his name, 27 to 29. The chapter describes the distractions of the mind and their accompanying effects, 30 to 31. It prescribes meditation on any object to combat them, with various examples presented, 32 to 40. Samapati is introduced with its varieties, 41 and 45, and their fruits, 46 to 48, and object, 49. The chapter concludes with a discussion of sampragata, preceding the final stage of asampragata, 50 to 51. So we've gotten to the goal. There is sadhana, and there is sadhya. Sadhya is the goal. And the goal in this yoga practice is the concentration, the focus of the mind, and eventually the transcendence of the mind. And now we've come to that point where that's actually described, when the vrittis of the citta, when the fluctuations of thought of the mind, citta vritti, nirodha, when they're quelled. And in this particular description, there were seven stages of samadhi that were described. You see, because yoga is based on experience, sometimes it's not always easy for those who have that experience even to communicate it. Because it's based on experience. I mean, there's communication. But the basic general idea is once the thoughts are subdued by this, then one enters into deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper focus and absorption. Sampragata samadhi, which is also called sub-bij, with a seed, with a foundation. It's a focus based on using the mind, the material mind. There were six stages that were described. And finally, one comes to the goal of this particular darshan, philosophy, or path, which is near beach samadhi, which is synonymous with asampragata samadhi, near beach, without any support. The concentration of the soul is by the soul, and not through any external lens or mechanism, which is what sampragata samadhi or sub-bij samadhi is. So just the general progression was kind of interesting. Is one is meditating on a particular object, according to how it works here, and the somehow or other the meditation is filtered through the name and the conception one has of the object. So although it's a focus and the the vrittis are being somehow are somehow subdued. There's some kind of intuitive, I guess, understanding of the object. Somehow or other, it's considered, it's the beginning stage, and somehow or other, the focus is conflated with the object and the conception and name of the object. Then they describe a deeper, and this is called Savitarika. And then the next stage is this Vitarika, is near Vitarika, that somehow or other one is experiencing the object just, I guess, directly. Maybe it would be something like you're tasting something and someone, you know, you have a conception of it. And we do have a conception of something. We may taste something, we may like it, we don't like, whatever it is. There's some conception. Somehow or other, it's directly, according to this school, it's directly imprinted on the mind. And it's a deeper meditation. And then there's vichara, which is two divisions, savichara and nirvichara, that somehow or other, there's a meditation that goes beyond, in Vitarika, you're meditating on the object, either without conception or with conception. But in this thing, it's not just the object, it's you're penetrating deeper into what the object is. Described just like if there was an iceberg or something. There's something that you're meditating on, but there's something deeper. It's some kind of vapor that's condensed or some atoms, or you somehow meditate, it's into the subtleness of the elements that compose it. And then somehow or other you come to Nirvichara Samadhi, where somehow or other the meditation goes beyond dimensionality. And at that particular stage, there's a super clarity. It's like described, you're standing on the mountain, and it's super clear. Your vision is super clear. This is Purusha. This is Prakriti. When you're in the mountain, you can't really... Now you're on the top. You're looking down, and you're seeing very, very clearly. And from this is born a samskara for very fine discernment. You can actually see. Right now, we don't see that clearly. We don't see we're not the body. We don't see the soul. They're kind of mixed together to different degrees according to our realization. But you actually see very, very clearly. And then from that comes a samskara that wants to restrain which wants to terminate all material thoughts, a kind of samskara. It's a terminating. The commentator, Dvaita says, calls it the terminator samskara. It just does not want to have anything to do with material life. There's such a clear discernment that you're basically come to a stage where there's one thought and one thought only in your mind. You become disgusted with sensual experience and you turn towards the self. So And the Chapati mistress says, you know, there's two possibilities by the mind. Either you pursue objects, or sense objects, you cultivate discrimination. In other words, you can use for enjoyment or for liberation. So now your only thought is not sense enjoyment, but it's liberation. And therefore, that powerful samskara, from this platform of near vichara samadhi, blocks the activation and emergence of other samskaras. They're blocked. So this is called the truth bearing wisdom, samskara pratibandha. It's obstructed this particular, let me see from this, what is it called? It's called the pragya. Yatra bhara tatra pragya. In this state, there is truth bearing wisdom. When it instructs other samara, and then eventually, somehow or other, that particular samskara, which is also based on the mind, somehow or other, I don't know how it works, by that process, maybe it consumes itself, and then one is in a sampragata samadhi. It's just the soul is aware of the soul, it's self-aware of the soul without any lens or object. Now, there in sampragata samadhi, after this nirvichara stage, it's anand, because one, when you're meditating, you see, when you're meditating, you're first meditating on an object, with some conflated with some conceptions or words, then just somehow the object, then there's the tanmatras, the subtle composition of the object, then it somehow goes beyond dimensionality somehow or other, and then eventually it comes to a meditation. What you're seeing is just prakriti itself, which is the subtlest of all material elements. And it's called anand because you come in contact with sattva. So you're actually experiencing this, a material goodness that is full of lucidity and peacefulness. And then finally, at asmita, you're just viewing the soul through the mind, which reflects the soul. But you're still, it's a sabija because it has the support of the mind. And then you come to this stage, which is the goal of the yoga process. I'm going to read some things just to agitate Mahamuni's mind. Then I'll let him comment. So this, they're describing this asapragyata samadhi. Despite this, Hariharananda states that some yogis wishing to do good to humanity can enter near beach for a specified time and then later reactivate their mind so as not to be able to function in the world for the benefit of others. This is something akin to the bodhisattva of the Mahayana Buddhism, who postpone irrevocably entering nirvana out of compassion for all embodied beings left suffering in samsara. To do this, it would seem that prior to entering the state of near beach samadhi, such a yogi would have to intentionally deposit a samskara in his or her citta to activate later as a thought that will pull the awareness of the yogi away from total absorption to the self and back into external consciousness mediated by the citta, a type of samskaric alarm clock arousing the yogi from samadhi. Vyas continues that one fully enters into nirbhij samadhi, the mind, along with all beneficial samskaras that were produced during subbhij samadhi, dissolve into its primary matrix, the undifferentiated prakriti. The nirodha samskar that allowed this, Vachaspati Mishra notes, do not provide the mind with a raison d'etre, raison d'etre, I don't know how to pronounce it, RAISONDETRE, French, raison d'etre, anyway. They do not perpetrate the mind's very reason to exist, as even the subbhij samskaras do by providing discriminating wisdom. So the mind no longer has any purpose to accomplish whatsoever. The Vachaspati Mishra points to 1118, which informs us that the mind exists solely to accomplish either of two functions, to provide material experience of samsara or to lead the soul to liberation. Now that the latter has been achieved in nirbhij samadhi, the mind, along with the beneficial truth-bearing wisdom samskaras that have brought it to this point, ceases all action. The mind, therefore, now unemployed, dissolves back into its matrix, prakriti, as a clay pot. Once its function has been accomplished, is discarded and dissolved back into the earth. Then, as Ramananda Saraswati puts it, while there is no cause, there is no effect, samsara ceases. And also, when you get to the stage of vichara, where you have absolute lucidity, then you're actually free from suffering. And all that's left is a sense of compassion for those who are still within samsara. So that ends this section. Mahamuni, you know, you on there? Hi, Bo? Mahamuni, are you still there? Do I need to do something to unplug people?
Haribol Maharaj, I'm here.
Okay, good. Just stuff, because we discussed, you know that there, you know, at this level of samadhi, then you have different darshans and they have different conceptions.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
What would you say are some of the challenges from maybe other schools or your own study to this conceptions of samadhi that's presented here? Because like up until samadhi, even Ramanuja you were mentioning, I thought was very interesting. There's no problem. The bhaktas go through that, you know?
Yeah.
The mind is transformed, but here's a particular, what do they call, objectless consciousness, you know?
Or contentless awareness.
Contentless awareness.
Yeah.
So, just, I'd be interesting. First of all, it's I'm finished now, so we have a little more time. So, you know, I'd like to hear just, you know, some of the insights that you get from your studies and just personal.
I guess if I can preface, Maharaj, some of the
yeah.
comments. I think that practically every important Indian school of thought, with one exception, advocates some kind of yoga. And so, in all the ancient texts, there's an idea that some kind of yoga must be practiced for self-transformation, even including the more rigorous, purely philosophical schools where people seem to be more like academics or something, they still advocate yoga. So I'm going to make some criticisms of the Yoga Sutra, but it's not to criticize the practices of yoga or the importance of this project, but what I think are kind of challenging assumptions that are there in the Yoga Sutra and the commentaries. I just wanted to make that point. So
yeah,
I'm not somehow trying to undermine the process, the goal of yoga, but...
Right. Every school has
its own challenge.
A foundation of agreement.
Right.
And then there's differences, and it's up to people to hear the different schools or have faith in a particular path and move in one way. Yeah, go ahead. But I'd like to hear this. It's
okay.
Interesting.
So... Well, just forgive me, one other quick preliminary is, I do think it's good to study the Yoga Sutra, but more for practice than for a metaphysical conception of reality, because I think that's where the real problem is. As far as I understand the Yoga Sutra, and I think that this is not an uncommon understanding, they say that every kind of experience requires prakriti, except for this contentless awareness. And when you're liberated, there's no thought, there's no experience, there's no relationships, there's no love, there's nothing but a kind of humming, a kind of humming state where you're just self-aware consciousness. And so if we take that seriously, then it seems to me that there's a lot of, you know, like you had mentioned this about 5 minutes ago, that the Yoga Sutra and the commentators tell us that this is a matter of experience. People tell us about these experiences. But strictly speaking, I'm not sure if that's entirely true, because if someone really went into samadhi, it's hard to imagine they'd have anything to tell you about it, and it's also hard to imagine that they could even remember it. Because all
I think it actually says that here.
Yeah.
You know, they actually say that themselves, or maybe Advaita is commenting on that. It says, let me read something, and then you'll go on. It says, the term nirbhaja seed indicates that this state is not related to any object that can plant the samskaric seed in the chitta, not even the nirodha samskar of the last sutra. It is, therefore, does not leave any record of itself in the chitta. The existence of the nirodha samskar can therefore be inferred, says Vyas, only by the lapse of time in the nirodha state. What he means is that when one enters into nirbhij samadhi, one is not aware of time, since one has no external awareness of anything prakritic at all, and since there is absolutely no frame of reference leaving its imprint on the mind by which one could gauge the passing of time, one can only infer that one has been in such a state after emerging from it and noticing the amount of time that has passed since one first sat down to meditate.
Yeah, this is remarkable to me, right? So let's say someone undergoes severe head trauma and they wake up 30 years later.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they were in, maybe we should just tell a story that they were in samadhi too. See, I hate not to be charitable here.
Yeah.
But I think that there are real yogic experiences, but they've framed them through a really crummy view of this in relation to Prakriti, where if the self has no inherent memory, if the self has no inherent volition, if the self has no inherent discursive awareness, then all these things they're telling us about how, you know, these are the products of reports. They're not products of reports. I mean, some of them are, but the higher level stuff, you can't report those things because there'd be no record of it. It's fairly obvious.
Yeah.
So I kind of like, to my mind, again, I'm not trying to attack all the yoga traditions, but I think that I'd rather take the yogic experiences and frame them in a different way, like the way theistic Vedantins do, that there are selves that have some kind of inherent life. You know, because like you even said, Maharaj, this Vrama samskara, the terminator samskara, said that, you know, it has to do with a deep, like detesting material life.
Yeah.
You put the word material, but as far as the Yoga Sutra is concerned, it's hating life. There's nothing else. They don't have an idea of transcendent existence as a person. And so, you know, it's... So there's a lot of, I think...
Well, there is some transcendent existence, but...
But not as a person. You're not personal. You're like a little kind of...
You're not God, though, but you're not... You're not...
But what do we think of persons? Persons are the kind of beings that can enter into relationships. Persons can undergo experience. A Purusha who's extracted from Prakriti cannot have experience, cannot undergo relationships. What is it? It's like a ghost. You know, I don't know. I just find the picture. I mean, who would want to work there? Who would want to work for many lifetimes for that? I'd rather take the pains and pleasures of mundane life, frankly.
Mm.
So, or better than that, I'd rather take the ecstatic relationship with God that we find in the Bhagavad Gita, frankly. So I don't know, Marj. I kind of...
Well, let me put it this way, and because we've discussed it when we had that conference.
Yeah.
That they, you know, it was very confusing to me because they said that the soul somehow has, you know, enjoyment, it has cognition, but I couldn't understand. You remember that quote?
But I don't know. I mean, so at this point, though, I don't know if... Satchinarayan Babaji Maharaj was talking about the Yoga Sutra.
Yeah.
But he was saying that I think his understanding of one, you know, Vaishnava Vedanta is that the soul has the potential to create awareness and stuff, but it's not inherently aware. I don't know. I think that view sounds...
I couldn't figure it out.
I couldn't either, and frankly...
But so here, it is, the soul has no cognition, or it
correct.
Needs a mechanism for cognition
yeah,
outside itself, and sometimes it has no cognition, has no enjoyment,
yep.
It has no emotions, but that's different from theistic Vedanta, which says those qualities are itself in the soul or something.
Well, I think there's also debates in theistic Vedanta, but at least theistic Vedanta has a more rich notion of the self and liberation, where the self and liberation can undergo experience of various things, can enter into relationships with God and with other souls, and can have a rich life in a way very different from this kind of, you know, contentless awareness of the Purusha. So there's so many things. So there's also this idea that, you know, there were these progressive levels of samadhi where you're experiencing something more fully.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, so would I be experiencing you more fully, Maharaj, if I was experiencing the atoms that your body was composed of? I mean, what does
I'm just
it mean?
Repeating what's here, like a parrot.
Sorry?
I'm just repeating what's there. But
I know. I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not. I'm just saying to you that.
Yeah.
Like,
well, what they would say is this, if there's two identical objects, right?
Yeah.
Basically, the yogi could tell the difference because he can see the difference in the atoms.
Well, there's this thing called a vishesha, which is supposed to be what distinguishes between two atoms which are otherwise identical.
Yeah.
And yeah, they can see these visheshas. Okay.
Well, they also say here that there's, and I said they said, I didn't go to that first. Kind of skipped it, but they said that the higher meditation is when you come into this high level of meditation, then a particularity of something. You know, you have like you say a cow, but so cow is a general thing,
yeah.
You know. The word cow itself is a general thing, you know, but you can actually get, the meditation allows you to go deeper.
But doesn't ordinary experience do that too? Like if I had 30 cows,
yeah.
I can see one of them and I'll know, hey, that's Bessie.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, Marge, I'm not trying to be flippant here.
No, you're not flippant.
I just
thought it's interesting at the end. I'm trying to... Yeah, I mean, it wasn't clear. And here's another interesting thing, is they do believe, as opposed to Advaita Vedanta, right?
Yeah.
They do believe that there is, that we are individuals different than God.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Once you get liberated, it doesn't seem that God has any function.
Yeah, it's not clear. But I think they have a good reason. If I remember correctly, there's arguments like, well, they say, well, look, we believe people have been liberated in the past, and if we're all just one jiva, or if we're all just one being, really, then if one of them was liberated, we shouldn't be in bondage right now. We should all be liberated. So that's a pretty good argument. You know?
It is.
So they have a good reason, you know. But it's, yeah, and, you know, it's tough. I mean, the weird thing about their view is God seems to be the only being who can't become liberated, because on their view, God is always acting, God's always doing things. But if the goal, if this great goal of yoga is to become an inert little chunk of self-aware consciousness, it's really a shame that God himself can't do that. And again, this may sound flippant, but my point is to say that I think their goal and their conception of the pure self, it's extremely emaciated. It's unappealing, and I think there's philosophical problems with it. You know, even this idea that a liberated soul can somehow decide to turn his mind back on, but if decision-making is a function of buddhi, not the pure self, which is what their view is, then how could a pure soul decide to turn his mind back on in order to engage in charitable works? These are fairly obvious questions, but I think we sometimes give a little bit too much credence to them saying, well, these are all the reports of experience. Well, maybe they are, but I think that a lot of this, as you just mentioned, are inferences, actually. And if they're inferences, then they can be subject to rational scrutiny like any other inference. And I think under rational scrutiny, this picture collapses. So, but my point is not to undermine the project here. I think the project, if I understand it, that you're engaging in, which is very important, is looking at one of the most rigorous discussions of yogic sadhana and trying to apply it in our lives. So to my mind, that's really beneficial. I would just want to try to extract the nice practice tips from this strange view, or this unappealing view of the liberated self.
Honestly speaking, I can't understand it. Of course, I'm coming from a different viewpoint. Here, again, despite this, Hariharananda states that some yogis wishing to do good to humanity can enter near beach for a specific time. Why would they want to do good to humanity?
Yeah, because what's there to be done unless they mean somehow encouraging them for liberation? I mean, everything else is just the fluctuations of prakriti, which are suffering, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
and then later reactivate their mind as able to function in the world for the benefit of others. To do this, it seemed that anyway, it's okay. I think it's really important, the things that you said, honestly, because I think people have to think about that. If this is their goal, then these are things that they have to confront.
Yeah.
And this other concept almost that there's nothing of the soul active when you're embodied. You know, that all your thoughts, determinations, conceptions, desire for liberation,
yeah.
You know, that it has nothing to do with you.
Exactly.
That also is a tremendous problem. And that concept is there also in many Vaishnav lives.
Well, I mean...
I know Vaishnavas that argue strongly for that.
Yeah, well, I don't know what to say. I think they suffer from the same problems. It seems to me, imagine this idea, that the entire pursuit of liberation is done by prakriti, and there's some Purusha that just happens to be lucky enough to be tied up with this chunk of prakriti that's going after liberation, and this Purusha enjoys the benefits. I mean, it's crazy. It just seems to make no sense to me. And if you're a theist, and you think that God somehow is setting this system up, well, why would God set a system up to reward beings who didn't deserve what they're getting? It would mean God is unjust, right? I mean, why would, you know, some soul who didn't do a damn thing for it get liberation while some other one suffers?
Because he has nothing to do with those decisions. They're all going on in matter.
But God,
yeah, it was very clear
God,
to me
God
that...
God covers matter, Maharaj. And this is even worse, because on their picture, there's only one being with freedom, and that's God. There's no other beings with freedom. So on their picture, God's more responsible for a people suffering than any other picture. You know, if we tell a story, right, we can say that it's because of karma. Individuals make bad choices. They suffer karma. They have free will. They can't tell that story. Their story is there's no being with free will except God. Therefore, any injustice in the world is God's fault on the Yoga Sutra picture, actually.
Not only, but many Vaishnavas accept that.
Well, again, but you know something? I'd want to see them defend it, because I think it's a pretty difficult and weak view. I mean, it's not appealing. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's...
Well, one thing is Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati definitively, and Pradyumna told me this, definitively quotes verses, etc., that there, you know, that there is spiritual thoughts, spiritual emotions, spiritual senses.
And that's one of the nice things that we can actually, I mean, we could make a point that there's a lot about the yoga with a capital Y, the yoga tradition, that's valuable, but that the theistic Vedanta can really solve that. And this is one of the great contributions of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta and Srila Bhakti Vinod and Srila Prabhupada, that many other Vaishnavas maybe missed. Maybe many other Vaishnavas caught up in the spell of this Purusha Prakriti dichotomy kind of have a view that's really problematic. But this could be one of our real contributions.
I really believe
this. I hope this.
I think so.
But anyway, I mean, there's a million ways to cash out these problems, and I'm sorry if this was not so systematic, my thought.
It was, no, it's pretty, I think it's fairly interesting, and I think it's fitting that it's the last day of this section on meditative absorption. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, I'd like to see someone from this school, you know what I'm saying?
I mean, I wrote to Professor
explain
Brown.
It.
Sorry. I sent that paper that I was just where I kind of got these thoughts together to Professor
yeah.
Bryant. And he was traveling, so it was a quick response, but he basically said that he feels like there has to be some freedom, there has to be some will in the Purusha, he feels. And he feels that potentially hasn't definitively dismissed that option. But I don't know. I know other scholars who say that Patanjali does definitively say that there's no freedom in the Purusha.
Yeah.
So he certainly seems consistent, but I don't know. I mean, if I may...
Yeah, please. I think this is very interesting.
There's something that I think we can do with all this. I mean, just like, you know, Advaita Vedantins, people who are into Advaita Vedanta describe an experience of merging. And they say this is experienceable evidence that this non-dual conception of Brahman is the highest. Theistic Vedantins don't say those experiences are false. What theistic Vedantins do is they say that's a real experience of merging into Brahman, but there's other ways to experience Brahman which are higher than that, and that what you're doing is kind of like, we would say, taking a swim in the Sundini Shakti, you know, the energy of Brahman by which everything is sustained. You are kind of experiencing that. But so I think in the same way, we can value and respect the experiences of the yogis and say these are real mystical experiences, but we can frame them in better pictures. We can frame them in a view that you can experience the Purusha, you know, maybe without the distraction of the mind, but that doesn't mean that their idea of Purusha and Prakriti, as they describe it, is the right one, because that's a metaphysical construction. It's not like their whole view is just the reports of yogis. And so my point is just not to say that we shouldn't respect their real meditative experiences and the hard work they put into it, but just to reject the crummy metaphysics that they use to frame it, frankly.
Hmm.
Is that okay, Maharaj?
I think it's not just that we represent theistic Vedanta. After all, I'm the one that's giving the class, and that's my tradition. But, you know, it just seems if someone else understands their philosophy deeper, you know, then, you know, I'm willing to hear. But as far as you know, this is their view because you're studying it in college. And that's the way it is represented, that there's no will in the Purusha.
Yeah.
I mean, that's their philosophy. So, I mean... once you take that away, the happiness is almost suicide.
Exactly.
Happiness is a freedom from something.
Yeah.
What is this contentless awareness? Is it a certain joy?
It would seem not, because joy is something that's added on to experience, right? I mean, it would seem like it's just a kind of, I can't even imagine it, you know, I don't know what to say. But if it lacks any kind of content, well, pleasure is a kind of content.
Okay, but it lacks the content of suffering.
Okay, that's it. And so again, I mean, this is the tough thing. I mean, I think so many Indian traditions have conceded way too much to Buddhist thought, frankly, historically. And they come up with ideas where, yeah, let's start from the fact that everything's suffering. I mean, Nyaya does this. Sankhya Yoga does this. You know, it's like the idea is there's so much suffering. Let that suffering be the sole motivation for our spiritual discipline.
Hmm.
And not that I think that we shouldn't use suffering as a motivation, but the whole idea is we just want to end the suffering. If that's the only reason to pursue liberation, well, let's say you take a good birth. You know, I'd rather enjoy good karma than kind of have some contentless awareness. God, that's boring as hell. It reminds me of how Vishwanath Chakravarti says that one of the benefits of Advaita Vedanta's idea that transcendence is a kind of boring, humming kind of awareness where there's no discursive experiences, it at least increases progeny in this world. Because people would rather go after mundane sex and work hard and become celibates for that kind of unappealing idea of transcendence. So in a similar way, I think that while suffering should be a good motivation, there should also be the positive hope for a deeper, more fulfilling experience of ourselves and of God and of everything else, which is a byproduct of our practices. Without that, it just becomes, as you just said, I think very importantly, a kind of suicide. So anyway, again, I was reading Professor Bryant's early drafts years ago and really inspired by a lot of it. So I'm not like an enemy of the Yoga Sutra, but
this concept of samadhi, it doesn't compute.
In so many
and it's not just I'm reading it now. I mean, these issues have been between me, you, and others have been, you know, for years. I mean, I heard from some people. You know what I'm saying? And it just doesn't. No one's been able to explain it to me. You know.
And for what it's worth, I mean, I do think that the tantric traditions, and by that I mean, in a broad sense, not just the weird stuff, but those yogic traditions which think that yoga is meant to transform yourself and transform the world, not just escape it.
Yeah.
The tantric traditions and the bhakti traditions, they all agree, I think, that this idea of the self, this idea of yoga simply as escaping, has real problems. And I think that there's a lot of voices in the great traditions of India that give a much more appealing idea of what the goal is of liberation and a more philosophically defensible idea of the relationship between the self and the matter. So, yeah, anyway.
And then there becomes the opposite criticism,
which is
when people take to yoga to increase their material enjoyment, which is